The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School.
Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap. On today's episode, Trident Room host Michael Gannon sits down and has a conversation with change advocate and Marine Sherman Neal II.
There are certain parts of our culture and our society that have become so nuanced into the culture and society that people forget what it means from any other perspective but their own. You know, and it's, and that goes to education, which is interesting. You know, Admiral McRaven, you know, the retired SOCOM commanding general, spoke in July of 2020 saying that education, our K through 12 education system, is a national security crisis. The Council for a Strong America, which is a advocacy group for a strong America, resiliency, and military preparedness and readiness, is also advocating for healthier children, children who are more physically capable, and then academically prepared. And as you talked about this, majority of the military enlist and comes out of the southern portion of the United States, and also is predominantly around military bases and institutions.
No,
yeah, there's some issues.
Yeah, and I know. So one of the ways that I avoid people having animosity when they're having these conversations is using myself again. And this is another one where I have the same experience that you do, as far as family members. So my dad's side of the family, the one that was not cited as being a terrorist, is actually from South Carolina. And he went to the Naval Academy. He had to go to NAPS first, even though he is qualified, because at the time, Strom Thurmond was a senator. And if you know anything about Strom Thurmond, you can assume that he did not want black people going to the Naval Academy or doing much else other than being his illegitimate. Anyway, I'll just leave that alone. So anyway, so my dad went to the Naval Academy. His three brothers, or one's a Marine officer, one's an Army officer, one's a Naval officer. My brother is a captain in the Air Force right now, and I have cousins that 05s. It's ingrained in our family. Now, myself, when I was 20 and I decided to join the Marine Corps, you know, I had 17 inches of dreadlocks, and I thought I was going to be playing football at, you know, for a period of time. So, no, all of those things did not lead to me, you know, becoming a Marine Corps officer or predestined to do something. But because of the way that I was socialized, you know, I naturally saw myself fitting in and overcoming some of the obstacles that a lot of black officers have to face. And so when we talk about the educational system and access, you know, if we continue to draw from these same pools and we don't adjust, one, the educational system, two, the Marine Corps itself, and really a lot of aspects of our government to reflect the best methods or methodology of recruiting, you know, the future officer, whether that's black, white, Native American, Mexican, man, woman, then we're going to end up getting the same people and the same product and the same ideas. If the Marine Corps made it to where they can recruit my son to be a third generation officer, that's great. What they really need to be focusing on is how do they get my son's buddy, who has no ties to the military, to look past a lot of actions or inaction that the force has taken to take a risk and join up, especially when they have options that are readily presentable through a million different forms of media in society today. So yeah, that's an issue in and of itself with the intergenerational, even regional. From an education standpoint, you know, we have to have these same conversations that we're having with kids as soon as they first open the textbook. as soon as they open a book, probably about in third grade, where they learn about these things, we have to tell them the truth. If we don't tell them the truth, then we're destined to fail. I read something good the other day about how, you know, every kid in the world knows that 5 people died at the Boston Massacre. What they don't know about is anything else of tangible importance with the Revolution, how, you know, the South, even at that point in time, was different from the North, how South Carolina and Georgia had their own economy, all that type of stuff. Because we want to preserve and present this. United States was great from the very beginning. We were allied at the very beginning. We had a quick meeting, you know, that led to funny videos over the Declaration of Independence, and it was all good. Like, no, the system was broken. That's what resulted in the Articles of Confederation. We dealt with it being broken, and people continued to fight, not for their tribe or their faction, but to preserve what we have. And Hish led to a Bill of Rights. Hish, again, was broken. And it's a continuous process. And so there's no great again time. And that's, I think, something that we need to emphasize. And even as a Marine Corps or Department of Defense overall, you know, as long as we continue to understand that and study what happened in terms for learning as opposed to what we should be doing, then we'll end up being a better force. But right now, you know, we still want to have nostalgia. And I say we, not the Marines, but as a teaching nation, it's easier to have the nostalgia and avoid those discussions because it's tough.
Yeah, history is riddled with horrible, horrible truths and reality. Crispus Attucks, African-American, Native American, killed at the Boston Massacre, and nobody knows his name. You know, Deborah Sampson, she served in the Revolutionary Army under, at the time, General George Washington, and got a pension for her service signed by President Jefferson. You know, and there's stories of amazing feats of accomplishments and everything that riddles our history. And then there's also stories of just horrible reality.
When you decide to take those half steps, it's only going to be more painful. So what I hope that we're learning right now is that, you know, there's no time for half steps, especially at the speed of information now and people's general apathy and towards government and congressional ratings being probably 1% favorability or whatever that is. And if we don't act now, we could potentially lose an entire generation or more of people, not only to join the military from a preservation standpoint, but really to participate in the government and believe in it.
And you know, arguably we could say, you know, the Confederacy won the culture war, which is...
And that you're 100% right. And that's part of the problem that we have here right now. And it's reminding me of General Burger's, you know, order is awesome. But the actual best thing that I saw come from a Marine general came from General Neller to follow that up. This is where he reconciled with himself, his actions, and the impact that it had on the Corps during his time as the Commandant to not take that same action. And to publicly speak about that and release a letter saying as much. Now that is a level of leadership that most of us can never get to from a vulnerability, humility standpoint, you know, in the wake of victory and people generally not asking you to do that. And so that with the South and Kentucky and these other states that are attached to the Lost Cause mythology is something that we haven't gotten yet. And I say we, not just as a black man or a United States military veteran or an American citizen. I'm saying that all of us in the United States as an entity have not gotten that from the South since Reconstruction due to adherence to this Lost Cause myth. The first step is to divorce ourselves from this mythology, which makes us dumber, because it goes into our textbooks, makes us most more vulnerable because we're lying to ourselves about our power, and then makes us more divided because the South did not include everyone. I'll just put it at that. And so until that happens, until the physical manifestation of that taking place happens, you know, we can't even begin the process wholeheartedly that, again, going back to the DOD and these conversations that General Austin's trying to start, can happen.
What do you think about the incremental changes? Because I think you shared a story with me about the importance of incremental changes, going back to your time at 2-7. You want to elaborate on that, and then we'll tie this back together?
Yes. So full disclosure, I stole the phrase incremental process improvement from now Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Godfrey, a mentor of mine, has helped keep... I frustrated many times, I'm sure, as a captain with no idea what I was doing. So I appreciate it. I'm good at copying what he says and trying to run with it until I get caught up. So there's that. And then as far as the incremental improvements, as you were bringing that up, I was, again, trying to think of experiences in my own time, both in the Marine Corps and out. And I remember in probably 2010 taking a Marine Ed course on, you know, what happens when we repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And it's literally like, hey, if you see, you know, a gay person, you know, you A, assault them, B, you know, some things that seem crazy now in 2021. And a course that hopefully nobody has the takes. I'm sure that they don't. I am certain that if we take women in integration right now, there's a lot of lessons learned where if we can go back in time, we wouldn't have made foolish statements before Congress or had certain procedures that clearly indicated that no women played any role in the decision-making process, etc. But we did the 70% solution the best that we could, and now we're in a better place than we were before. And that's no different with these issues here. The tough part is, you know, when do you accelerate the pace? When do you allocate more resources? And that brings me back to what I saw at TBS, again, with integrating women. We still have a significant gap of minority officers that serve not only in the officer corps overall, but specifically within the GCE. I know that I was acutely aware of that before I became a second lieutenant. And my objective was to be an infantry officer, not because I like weapons, but because I knew that that was the way to accelerate and hit all those steps that you talked about and not have a ceiling. And if any of y'all listening have been in the Marine Corps, you know that if you look at your suppos and your logistics officers as opposed to your artillery officers and your infantry officers and your ground intel officers, there's a dynamic there that exists. There's a culture there that exists. What part of that culture is making it so the other cannot get in? And is that good for the Corps? Is that good for the country? Is that good for retention? All of those questions that we can peel back and ask ourselves. I would purport to say that the answer is no. I would say that, you know, whatever is creating that dynamic needs that be identified so that it can be addressed and corrective action can be taken, because I think it limits, you know, a lot of good people from staying in or getting into positions of leadership that will make the Corps better overall. And then just in terms of everyday processes, and you'll remember this from 2-7, and again, with how tough it is, and not to make it even a story so it doesn't sound like I'm holier than thou or immune to it. I remember when we returned from a deployment and we were going to get our first female into the battalion. And we literally had to hold mock meetings before she came because who knows what type of, not bad intention, but, you know, sexist and non-inclusionary words we were saying in meetings. And such is what happens when you just have know, 100% males operating. No different than what it would be if you had 100% females or 100%, you know, a certain race operating. And so just doing that exercise alone and checking your own language bias, etc., and correcting small actions within the unit will lead to the larger action. And that's what's on really your individual Marines to do every day. And that requires them to, one, ask another Marine that's not like them, how does XYZ make you feel? Listen to them actively, and then internalize that and decide to change because they're better working together that way. And then on the grander scale, you know, implementing that into the force writ large to not create a culture, but to shift the culture to reflect, you know, what the force is now, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Do you think the military, as it gets better and as, you know, the things that General Berger and other leaders have done, you know, sort of addressed the sins of the past, do you think that will help, you know, bring forth the reconciliation, I guess, our society so deeply needs at times?
I hope so. I'd be lying if I said I was 100% sure, because I do think that we're at a pivotal point right now. Two examples of that is in sports, a lot of the same things happen that you just brought up. So we say, good job, Jackie Robinson, and then we talk about his baseball career, but we don't talk about the fact that as a lieutenant, he got arrested for trying to integrate a bus. We talk about Jesse Owens and don't talk about we talk about his gold medals that he won, but don't talk about the fact that he couldn't go to the White House when he got back and what he had to face in 1936. And we do the same thing with people like Martin Luther King Jr., Muhammad Ali, and talking about he literally went to jail, lost his livelihood for his service. So I know that's something that we've talked with our team about to try to correct that and show that, you know, they're beyond the tweet of what it takes. And so the military, what gives hope is that, you know, for the most part, you have to go beyond the tweet because you have to live in the barracks every day. You have to command every day. You have to do work. Now, is that 100%? No, I'm not that far removed where it's all nostalgia time and it's all sunshine and rainbows. But for your competent leaders, that is the case. And I'm talking, you know, NCOs, even lieutenants and on up. So why was I hesitant to say that the military is the way right now? It's because one of the few times since leaving the Marines that I want to go back and spend a day in the battalion was when General Mattis decided to leave the White House, because I knew it would tell me a lot, because where people invest themselves into these great men and it becomes a cult of personality, vice what we're supposed to be fighting for, which is the country and the Constitution, it creates a situation where you have to choose between your values and beliefs or worship of an individual. And I'm certain that there were many individuals that heads were exploding there because the two people that they purported to love diverged ideas. One of those people diverged in defense of the Constitution. Now, I know there's a whole nother talk on that, but you know, how do they reconcile that? How did hyper conservative people in the Marines are hyper conservative, it's not a mystery there, reconcile General Mattis and his decision to leave with the cult of personality that the commander in chief had at the time and talk through that? Were those discussions being held? I'm certain that, you know, there is animosity there. And, you know, if we can get to the point where we're willing to discuss, you know, the impact of that and the impact of, you know, giving away our ideals as a country for cults of personality and how to avoid that, well, let me know how far that we've made. And I'm sure that you're leading those type of discussions right now. And will avoid us from you know, falling into the abyss because we've succumbed to the next cult of personality, which we may not survive, as opposed to making sure that we, the foundational documents that we have give us a rudder steer that we need.
You know, with the cult of personality, I think we saw this in 2008 with the election of President Barack Obama. I think we saw that there is a cult of personality, and that his election in and of itself was going to somehow magically, like a Mr. Clean magic eraser, like wipe away, you know, all the transgressions and issues and, you know, cultural issues and subcultural issues along racial, ethnic, socioeconomic backgrounds. Like, it was just like election alone was just going to solve everything. You know, I think this will probably be the last caveated, you know, social commentary between us today. You know, that I hate to use the term, but like that is the argument of cancel culture, what have you. Have you experienced any of that with Murray State, in like people not willing to engage? They just want to shut down the conversation before having the conversation?
No, I certainly have. And I heard you try to say the word, then get away from it quick, because I hate that phrase too, with cancel culture and whatever that means. And no, I actually embrace it. So I like to ask people, what does cancel culture mean to you? And then, what is your issue with what's being canceled? So if this constitutes cancel culture, then why is that bad? But there's certain limits in things that, you know, we can't accept as society in certain places. If we expect, you know, fairness and outcomes, and we truly want to include everybody into society, which is why, you know, looking at not just the fact that it's Robert E. Lee or a Confederate statue that's out in space, by having it in place on government property at a courthouse, you know, under certain circumstances in the early 1910s and 20s, for certain reasons, we can cancel that. We have a basis of reason and logic, which lets us know that this isn't compatible with who we are, what we want to be. If you go through that evaluation for anything that's considered cancel culture, and you come to a reasoned conclusion, then that's okay with me. You can call it cancel culture. It doesn't hurt my feelings. It's just there'll be a new phrase next week. But you know, it's kind of with the standards, and you know, with integration with the Marines and women for a long time, it's you're going to change everything. You know, standards are going to go down. Like, no, they're not. They haven't, to my knowledge, at least. So, is it the person itself that is irritating you, or is it truly an adherence to the standard? With the United States, there's never been a time where we said, okay, North Korea, you know, North Vietnamese, the Nazis, whatever enemy that you want to pick, go ahead and fly that, erect that statue. Like, the standard hasn't changed. So it's your adherence to a specific person, individual belief that's in conflict with the standard that you want to create a term to warp it and make that one okay, or that the exception. So the good thing about the military, to wrap that up, is, you know, there's clear and defined standards. There's a shared experience and a generally agreed upon history that you can fall back on. Going back to Admiral McRaven, that's what we don't have right now, which is what makes the situation nationally dangerous. We don't have agreed upon standards. We don't have a lot of shared experiences, seeing as that we're stratified economically and by race, by whatever other class you want to bring up. And regionally, especially, as we talked about. Firstly, thank you for having me on, and you know, having the chance to speak to this audience in particular. It's pretty awesome. Something that I didn't have on my goals list or think that that would happen as a captain when I was in the Marine Corps, and definitely did not think that this would be my conversation after leaving several years ago. So I appreciate that, and you know, the opportunity to speak to such an esteemed audience is awesome. The only thing that I'll leave y'all with is, you know, I hope that every time someone hears me and they hear something that they disagree with or agree with, they take the time to can reach out and tell me, because this whole process is about self-improvement. Everything I learned is from sitting around some rock or piece of sand, putting an MRE on some rock or something, or sitting in my office and not getting any work done for days at a time because we're discussing these very things. And that's where all this happens. And that's the best part of what the experience in the military is. And I truly believe that, you know, those units that can foster a genuine sense of caring through active listening and improving each other through challenging each other are more successful on the football field, the battlefield, and in their own lives. So I just ask that you continue these discussions, improve upon them, and understand that it matters to Marines that you may not even see every day. Because, like I said, I saw the example set by General Berger, and I know those discussions didn't just pop up overnight in his head. And I know that that's a man who had those discussions. I know that General Neller, going back and conducting a self-analysis of his position, had those discussions. And that tells me a lot about who they are and what their character is. And so it'll be the same for you. So I appreciate it again.
Always. Thank you, Sherman. Kind words. You give me too much credit. I'm just a guy who studies and likes to talk and ramble.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room.
This episode was recorded April 5th, 2021.
For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes. The Trident Room has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at tridentroompodcasthost@nps.edu and find us online at nps.edu/tridentroompodcast.